Before Billie Eilish, before the Go-Go's and Joan Jett, there was Susie Quatro. The undisputed queen of rock sold 50 million records and set the bar for female musicians everywhere. Now, a new documentary called Susie Q aims to set the record straight on how Susie created the blueprint for women in rock. My name is Chris Kosach. I created this program to highlight the written account of music, from band biographies to artist memoirs and the occasional rock doc too. We're the only podcast of its kind. This is Text, Prose, and Rock and Roll. Track 6, Susie Quatro. All right, you were born in Detroit Rock City, and you've got a name like Susie Quatro. You were destined to be a rock star. You know that, right?
It's amazing. First question lots of people ask me, including my husband, what's your real name? That's my real name. No, it's a good name, isn't it?
It's just a solid name. Yeah.
So how lucky was that? How lucky was that?
Well, I don't know if it was luck. I think it was fate. I really do.
Yeah, destiny.
Really, seriously. So, all right. So they say that children are who they're going to be at around the age of 5.
I agree.
And you just learn more stuff after that.
Yeah, yeah.
So at the age of 5, you were watching television and something came on the screen that changed your life forever. What was it?
We were watching the Ed Sullivan Show. I was actually 6. I think 5 going on 6. Anyway, Ed Sullivan was the family variety show, and all the families would sit down and watch it together. And at the end of the show, Ed Sullivan would always say, I always remember him doing it, and now something for the youngsters. And he would bring out something for the youngsters. And Elvis Presley came out. Okay. So one of my sisters, 9 years older, the oldest one of the family, she was 15. She was screaming at the TV set. And there's me looking at her. I'm a little girl. I'm going, why are you screaming? And then I turned into the camera. There's Elvis. And I'm going in. And it hit me. First thought, like a light bulb. I thought, I'm going to do that. It's amazing, that age. I'm going to do that. And it never occurred to me he was a guy and I was a girl. It was a light bulb moment.
Yeah.
Stayed with me my whole life. So I discovered myself very, very young.
I love that.
Yeah. It's a true story. I can't believe it happened. It's crazy.
Yeah. He wasn't in his leather period, right? No,
but that is when he's when I was 18 and I've been 4 years in a band at that point.
Uh-huh.
Looking for the image, looking for what you do, always rock. And I saw his comeback special. I was on the road. I can't remember where I was. And I saw him and he had leather on. And another light bulb moment, I went, oh, yeah, I'm gonna wear leather. I like that. It was me. So I went out and bought a leather jacket the next day. So there you go. And it's
that's so cool. The band you're talking about is the Pleasure Seekers?
Yes.
Is that right?
My first band.
As we were saying, you come from a very musical family. Your dad, your sisters were in the band. Even your brother was a booker. And he got you on some pretty great bills. But at some point, you weren't happy, right?
My brother, Michael Quatro, was a promoter. And he booked us on one of his festivals. But not the Pleasure Seekers, Cradle. The next wave, the next band. We got heavy and started to write our own songs and everything, you know, and it went our area. I didn't like it. But yes, he used to book us on festivals, correct.
Yeah, you said that in the documentary, Susie Q, that you just really weren't into the second band, Cradle. How come?
The Pleasure Seekers were fun. I sang 95% of the songs. I was the front person. I enjoyed that entertainment value of that band. I thought it was fun. It was a good way to learn your craft. We did 5 shows a night, you know. We played all the time. Then we went on a festival that my brother put us on, and we were so outdated because we had been playing clubs. And all of a sudden, the hippie thing, and we weren't part of that. We were on the road. So we kind of lost touch with that generation, and we kind of died. And then we decided to change the band. Well, I didn't decide. Everybody decided. And I was put back a bit, mainly just playing bass. I did maybe 6 songs a night. And my little sister was brought in because she could sing. The whole family was talented. And she had more her finger on the pulse of that era of music. So we had a change, but it wasn't to my liking. I got really good on my bass, which is a good thing, but I am not a musician in a band. I'm a fun person. Mm-hmm. So when that was taken away from me, I didn't complain about it because I figured everything happens for a reason and use it to learn and jam. And I did solos and so all part of that was very valuable. But I didn't like the direction the music took at all. It went very heavy and very contemplating or naval type of thing. Wasn't me. Mm-hmm. I'm more of an entertainer. Became more of a jamming band.
Yeah, but it's kind of a necessary evil though too, because you were playing with Cradle when the producer Mickey Most came to town to play with Jeff Beck at Motown. Of course, this is Detroit we're talking about, so Motown's there. And he came by to see you at the club. Tell us about that night.
In all honesty, my front person light was being hidden under a barrel because the band had changed. But that didn't stop Mickey Most from seeing the band. I did two songs, and he said, "You, here." So whatever's going to happen to you is going to happen to you. You know what I'm saying? There is such a thing as destiny. There's such a thing as following your path. That was my path. I didn't know it, but the week before Mickey Most had seen me, we had got seen by Elektra Records. And the president, Jack Holtzman, he offered me a solo contract too, but nobody told me about that or about Mickey. He wanted to take me to New York and make me into the next Janis Joplin. I didn't hear about this till later. And Mickey Most wanted to take me to England and make me into the first Susie Quattro. So,
yeah, nobody wanted the band. I mean, that's interesting to me, but that's a common story. You know, that happens quite a bit.
It's not an unusual one. Often you get somebody picked up. That happens. You know, it's nothing to brag about. And it's nothing to feel bad about. It just is what it is. It's your life taking on the path it's supposed to take and you following it. That's how I see it. Whatever that path may be, you know, if I was supposed to drop out of the band at some stage, I would have done. If I was supposed to not be the lead singer, it's just all a matter of believing in yourself and following the road. There's the road sign, you know? I'm sure you feel the same as people do.
Oh, I absolutely agree. But that's the point. There was no path when you started. So you, Susie Quattro, had to actually draw the path for everybody that came after.
I didn't have a blueprint. Yeah. That's the reason I wanted this documentary to be made, was to show people that I did not have a blueprint. I had nobody I could point to and say, "Oh, I'd like to be like her. It didn't exist. So I had to have a lot of self-belief, not ego, a lot of self-belief, be sure of who I was, stick to it, let nobody change it, and just let that light shine. I had to believe in me. There was a chance I wouldn't make it. Who knows? You don't know anything, you know? All you can do is stay true to yourself. And if the movie has a message, it is, stay true to yourself, because it's all you have. I've got to hold on to me. Save me, save me, save me, save me. I've got to hold on to me. You can't take away my soul."
You were an inspiration to me, and of course, like so many Americans, and I'm hopping all over my page, but I gotta jump to the Happy Days stuff, because for so many little girls, including myself, that was the first time we saw you. I didn't know you were this worldwide phenomenon. Happy Days, you played Leather Tescadero, and you got that gig because you were on the cover of the Rolling Stone.
Yes.
So, which is great. So tell me about the day that you got the phone call from the producers.
We were on tour in Japan. And by the way, before I say that, I don't care how you came to my table. You came to my table, so welcome.
Thank you.
I was in Japan on tour, and my publicist called me and said that they were considering me for this series. I didn't know the series. He said, "It's worth it." Got on the plane, went over there, met the director, met the producer, I read the script for them a little bit. I was taken outside to meet Henry. And then they said, go back to your room, because we had a hotel room, and we will discuss you and we'll call you.
Right.
So, this is so funny. Because Elvis has sat on my shoulder my entire career. So I'm in the hotel room waiting for the phone to ring. The TV's on in the background. It rings. I picked it up and they said, congratulations. We don't just want you for the two-parter. We want you for 15 episodes. I said, great. And right at that moment, simultaneously, I'm happy here. The TV says, newsflash, the king is dead.
Oh.
You can't write this stuff.
That's August 1977.
Yeah. The phone call and the TV. It's amazing. I get goosebumps when I say it. Then when I came back, I think September to film, I walk in the studio and they said, oh, Susie, come here. We want you to meet somebody. And they said, this is Nudie. He's going to make all your clothes for the series. He's Elvis's personal tailor. How does this happen?
Really?
Yeah. So strange. And to finish off the Elvis connections, he used to go at the top of Rodney Bingenheimer's disco, and he used to watch videos of me and listen to my music, and he used to look at this poster of me. Nothing sexual. I think he found me interesting. His last girlfriend told me this. And I wrote a song for him called Singing with Angels. You must listen to it. It's become a cult hit. It was done with James Burton, his guitar player, and the original Jordanaires. So it's all about him. And if I had ever met him, this song wouldn't exist. So it's important I wrote the song. That was my last little connection, I think. Who knows?
I heard your voice late last night. I heard you say, are you lonesome tonight? I saw you crying in the chapel light. Love me tender and treat me nice. Lonely boy got the GI blues.
There's trivia out there that he wanted to work with you, but you said no. Is that correct?
He wanted to meet me. I was in Memphis, 1974, and all shook up, my version. Mm-hmm. Had just gone into the sort of, I think, number 41 or something, just gone into the lower end of the charts. And I got a phone call in my hotel room, and it was his people. And before I could even catch my breath, he got on the phone. And mm-hmm. he said, I've just heard your version of All Shook Up, and I think it's the best since my own. And would you like to come to Graceland and meet me? And I went, I'm very busy.
Don't meet your idols. You didn't meet your idol.
I mean, I just put the big J for jerk. But the truth is, I wasn't quite ready. Wasn't scared to meet him. Wasn't quite ready. I only had mm-hmm. a few hits, and I just kind of wanted it to be a little bit more equal when I met him. So I felt a little bit more, you know, kudos. And I didn't know he was going to die early. But if I had met him, that song wouldn't exist. And that song needs to exist, believe me. And I wrote that for him, and I wouldn't have written it at all. And you get, like I said, Elvis impersonators record that song now. It's played at funerals, and he definitely inspired me.
Yeah, well, it's very clear that he did. You're amazing. When you were in England, you were lonely at the time. You were all alone. You start working with Mike Chapman. He starts writing heavier bass lines for you to shine, right? But your persona...
He didn't write. Nobody ever wrote a bass line for me in my life. I have to put that right.
Oh,
what he allowed.
Okay, sorry.
No, that's fine. He allowed me to play my bass the way I wanted to do it. I mean, he allowed me to be upfront with it. You know, mm-hmm. that's what he meant. I mean, the early stuff that Mickey Most did with me. I mean, I'm a good bass player, and it was in there, but Mickey didn't have it shoved up so high in the mix. When Mike mm-hmm. made the records with me, he took what I was doing and mixed it mm-hmm. high up in the records. That's what he's saying. He let me play like I play. I always play the same. Nobody ever tells me what to play to this day. In fact, you can only suggest, and even then I won't listen. But...
Hey, at least you're honest.
I'm sorry, I'm on a roll now. What he did was he pushed it up front. So this good bass playing that I was doing that maybe Mickey was keeping down, he put it right in the front of the record. And I even took the solo bits on Can the Can, you know. So, yeah, he let me fly with my bass. He didn't tell me what to play, but he let me fly, which was a smart thing.
So smart, because that makes your musicality up front, takes away a little bit of the pretty girl there, but it just gives you more street cred as a bass player.
But I am a bass player. That's what I am.
Exactly. But unfortunately, as you know, and the looks and the image are so important in this day and age to an artist's success. You talk in the documentary Susie Q about the day that you did that photo shoot in your black leather and they said, give us a look. And she came alive. Can you tell that story, please?
Yeah, it was honestly one of the pivotal moments of my life. We had made Can the Can, and Mickey Most thought it was going to be a number one. He said, oh, you've got a big hit here. So let's discuss. I remember it sitting in the, let's discuss your image. Cause now was the time. Had the record, had the band. Now was the time for me to break. So I said, okay, leather. I remember it. He said, no. I said, yes. He said, no. I said, Mickey, I want to wear leather. And I remember him saying, it's been done. I said, not by me. So he said, he looked at me for a minute and then he said, how about a jumpsuit? And I honestly made the roof cave in on me. I had no idea. No idea it was going to be sexy. Wasn't even in my head. I said, great. I thought, because I'm a very, you know, energetic performer. Everything will stay in place and I can do whatever I like. Nothing to iron, nothing to zip up. Wonderful to zip, that's all. And then we were at the photo shoot. My record's playing on the speakers. I always remember it. Record's playing. So there's my record with my band playing. I've got my first jumpsuit on. The band are draped on the floor around me, so I'm in charge. And I'm like, it's surreal. It's surreal. And the photographer, he says to me, give me that Susie Quattro look. And I remember doing that iconic, that's on the poster, that look. All of a sudden, everything made sense. Give me that Susie Quattro look. Okay, here it is. I guess it's all the years leading up to that, you know, and I was sensitive enough to know that this was my moment and everything fit together like a jigsaw puzzle. So the Susie soul from the Pleasure Seekers Entertainer, the bass player from Cradle, you know, and then those 18 months of loneliness, and then Can the Can, the jumpsuit, the bass, the band, bang. Come out with your fist line and your bass up at 11.
Pretty much every popular band plays Top of the Pops and some unknowns too. At the time you were an unknown and you played Top of the Pops, the very next day you went down the pub, as they say. Tell us what happened.
I was just excited and I said to my ex-husband, who was still good friends, I said, let's have a drink. And we walked in the pub and everybody started screaming. It was so strange. I kind of looked behind me to see who else had walked in. I thought somebody famous had walked in. Didn't realize it was me that had walked in. And we had to leave because it was mobbing. It was mobbing. They were all rushing. And that was it. That was actually the change of life.
So let's fast forward. You have sold 55 million records worldwide. You were a mentor to so many people that are household names today. Just to name a few that are in the documentary Susie Q: Chrissy Hynde, Lita Ford, Cherie Curry, who adores you. They all do, actually. Debbie Harry, Katie Tunstall, Wendy James, Tina Weymouth, and Joan Jett, above all, says that you were integral to her career. So I'd like to know, what was it like the first time you met Joan?
That was, my first impression was how cute she was, just cute. And she was in my hotel waiting for me, after the show, waiting for me with lots of stuff to sign. I just thought it was cute that she was sitting there with my haircut and my jacket. And I thought, Oh, and you know, and that she continued to do that. And then I found out that she formed a band. And I said to my publicist, who told me, I said, "Hallelujah." He said, "What do you mean?" I said, "She needed to do that. She had to find an outlet because it was like too much, you know." And she went on to have great success. So I was happy that she made it into something, not just a fan, that she made it into something for her. And everybody starts somewhere, you know. Look at me with Elvis, you know. I was her touchstone. And she obviously looked at me and thought to herself, "I have that in me." And she did, because she proved it.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, the band she started was the Runaways with Lita Ford and Sherry Curry.
And you know, it's all good. And so is Lita. She's a lovely girl.
Yeah, I don't think a lot of people realize that her entire look, even me to some degree, it was like leveled up a little bit. Her entire look, not just the haircut, not just the everything, it's you.
Yeah, that's what Lita says. Lita says it in the film. And like I said, everybody starts somewhere. How many people watched Elvis and took stuff?
Absolutely.
And any good performer, to be honest, to be fair, any good performer watching somebody that they go, ooh, and they love that person, if they're a performer themselves, if they're going to be a performer, they will find little bits that resonate that they can maybe take and put through in their way. But she had a lot of me. Not now. She's gone her own route now, and I've gone mine. But the beginnings, mm-hmm. Quattro, that spoke to her. 1,000,000%.
Right.
That's who she wanted to be.
Right. But of course she did her own thing. So
sure she
she's gone on her own way. But that's amazing.
That was her starting point. That's all.
Yeah. Tell me about the beginning of this documentary. How did it come to fruition?
A guy called me, and it's on my bucket list, always has been. Wanted to do a documentary. And so we were talking on the phone, and he said, "I just want to tell you straight away before we go any further that I'm not a fan," which made me laugh. That's an icebreaker for you. So he said, no, don't get me wrong. He said, "I like your music. I'm just not a fan." I went, fine. That's not a problem. I said, "Then just tell me then, why do you want to do this film?" And he said, "Because I saw you talking on a television show. And you fascinated me." So I thought, okay, this is the kind of guy I want to do my film. I don't want somebody to kiss my ass. I want somebody who will be objective. I want somebody who will argue with me. And this was the right guy. And the only thing that I insisted on, and I stuck to it religiously, I did have editing scissors. And I said, I'll tell you now, I don't want wonderful. She's wonderful. I said, I just don't want that kind of documentary. Mm-hmm. I want it to be open. I want it to be raw. I want it to be emotional. I want people to laugh, applaud, to cry. I want it all. I want my story to be told. I want the record straight. And I said, even if there are cringe moments where I wish I could crawl out of the theater, if they're real, they're in. And you'll notice in that documentary, everything stayed in. Because I wanted the truth. And there were moments I wanted to crawl out. But what I call the cringe moments, they're the best parts in the film. And this is when you get to know me and the struggle I had and what I had to fight, both emotionally and business-wise. You know, it was not an easy road. I didn't have somebody I could point to and say, I want to be like that. It didn't exist. So I was on my own. I was on my own. All the time.
Alice Cooper says here in your documentary, Suzy Q, that you just couldn't take the Detroit out of her. You got grit, lady. You got grit. So I appreciate very much that that you were so honest and humbling and left things in that your sisters said. And for listeners, they should definitely watch the documentary to see for themselves to what you kind of went through. Some of that's pretty harsh.
Yeah. It is.
But rock and roll gets ugly, though, too. There's loneliness. Let's get to the heart of the matter with the sexism and the chauvinism, because good God, lady, you had your fair share of that. How did you deal with that?
I have a no-nonsense approach. I'll say it this way. I am a tomboy, but I'm also cute with it, okay? I can tell a dirty joke. I can be bawdy with the guys, have a drink of bubble. But I keep my feminine card in my back pocket. I keep my balls in my head. Okay? They won't get kicked there. And I keep my feminine card in my back pocket. And if somebody steps out of line, out comes the card. I hardly ever have to use it. I know you're talking about one part where I got slapped on the rear by but, and I've explained this at my Q&As. That was a real moment. I had just won Rear of the Year, and he waited till we got on the stage, and it was a live television show. So I'm on a live TV show. I'm being interviewed. It was a big show. And it went through my brain very quickly when he did that. Do I do something? Do I let it pass? So I went the professional mode, and I just let it pass. If he had done that backstage, he would have been on the floor.
That's good for a lot of little girls to hear that, though, too. But yeah, but you're class act. You played it right. You played it straight. You played along. Have you found you've had to play along in the music industry once in a while? Not just that, but like the press. The press wanted to skewer you.
I am told by everybody who knows me that I am not diplomatic in that way. I'm not a bullshit artist. If you ask me something, I'll tell you what I think. I've been told by many, don't go to business meetings because I don't like to play the game. Why do I have to waste my time playing a game? If I want to say this, I want to say, why don't you just say what you think? And I'll say, it cuts out the middleman. Let's just be straight. I think you must have got that from the film. I'm a straight talker. I'm a straight talker.
You are. Henry Winkler says there's very little bull in you. So for sure. Are you guys still tight? The people that are in this documentary, are you like in constant contact with these folks?
I'm still tight with everybody. Henry's was one of my favorite comments in the film. And Debbie and Cherie, she did my song. But Debbie, I'll tell you a little secret. When I first was watching the cut of the documentary, and Debbie Harry comes on, and she says, I'm laughing at it now. She says, Suzy Quatro was so beautiful. I asked the director if I could add something to that, just my voice. I wanted to go, fuck off, Debbie. I can't hear Debbie Harry tell me I'm beautiful. I can't hear that, and I won't hear it. And he said, no, you can't put that in. This because I thought it would have been for anybody. Suzy Quatro, Suzy, or fuck off, Debbie.
That's okay. That could be in the director's cut, right?
Yeah, it would make me laugh. But she was one of the iconic beauties. But I crack up laughing. I never grew up with looks in my arsenal, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. You didn't play it up. You've got it. You just don't play it up. Anita Sparks, I think, says that you don't play it up, which worked in your favor.
I guess. I mean, I didn't even... When's the first time I even knew I looked okay? God knows. Maybe in my late 20s. But even so, I'm not comfortable even talking about it. You know, I'm not really a makeup girl. I wear it sometimes when you're supposed to. But I'd rather that you appreciate my brain, appreciate my bass playing ability, like my voice, appreciate my artistry, and leave the people who play the looks card to them. I don't want to do that. I never have. Mm-hmm. Never have.
You know, in many ways, I'm going to opine here for a sec, if that's okay. In many ways, you were in the right era for sure in the 70s, because I was a VJ at MTV. And in the 80s and the 90s, it was all about the look, all about the look. And there's so many amazing musicians who just didn't make it because they couldn't make it on MTV. And I face for radio. You hear that all the time. I came from radio. I'm okay. But with MTV in the 80s and the 90s, and even now, it is really all about the looks. So the fact that your music spoke for itself might help too. But again, you can't get past what Danita said, that you are sexy as hell. You are, and you have to know that.
You embarrass me. It's okay. I think the sexiness comes from something inside. I don't. Yes. I've never purposely gone out there and tried to be sexy. I just move how I move. I feel how I feel, and it just kind of all flows through. Sometimes when I'm watching myself, I'll critique my own stuff. I think, oh, I didn't like that, or I didn't like that, like everybody does. I'm sure you listen to your shows and think, oh, I could have done that better.
Awful all the time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But you can look at it in third person almost and appreciate it. I can see what people see when they say that to me. But my own belief is I'm sexy because I'm not trying to be sexy.
Right.
I'm just not.
But you're confident. You will concede that you're confident.
Yes, it's confident. Yes, I believe in my craft. And it's not ego. It's a confident. It's a self-belief. And I say this and it's my personal mantra. And now you got me being serious. I said it when I got my honorary doctor of music at Cambridge University. I didn't even graduate high school, and I am Dr. Quattro. Can you believe that? I can't believe it. But I went up there, and I had my speech on the side, and me being me, I just flung it. I thought, no, I'm just going to talk. I looked out at all the hats and the gowns and all these intellectuals I'm wearing, and I found myself speaking, and then I was in tears. I said, our job in life, all of our jobs in life, doesn't matter if you're male, female, black, white, rich, poor, if you're a janitor or if you're a housewife, doesn't matter. Our job, we each have a little light. Go in, find it, switch it on, and let nobody switch it off.
The documentary Suzy Q is now available on Apple TV, with further distribution coming at a later date. It's an inspiring story, and I hope that you'll make time for it. And that'll do it for this episode of Text Prose and Rock and Roll. A huge thanks to my guest, Suzy Quattro, for her generosity, kindness, time, and many years of inspiration as well. Be sure to join me next time when we delve into the story of Laurel Canyon and the many bands that came out of there. Okay, here come the liner notes. Text Prose and Rock and Roll was created, written, and executive produced by yours truly in association with GoTo Productions, Charlene Goto producer. Thank you to my guest, Suzy Quattro, and her team, Cece Cronin at Sicily Publicity, Teddy Dolan at New Haven Publishing, and Tate Brady at the Acme Film Company. Also, thank you to Suzy for her generosity in letting us play clips of her music. If you'd like a longer listen to Suzy, and I highly recommend it, be sure to check out the playlist that we've created of all of Suzy's big hits and some other amazing favorites as well. You'll find that on Spotify. And one final thank you to Kathy Valentine for coming up with the great idea to do a soundtrack. Kathy Valentine, of course, from the Go-Go's, will be a guest on an upcoming episode of this show. We appreciate your feedback. Be sure to subscribe, rate, and comment wherever you found this podcast, or visit us at textprosrockandroll.com. And please follow us on Instagram to be among the first to see who's coming up on future tracks. For Text Prose and Rock and Roll, I'm Chris Kosach. Rock on.